Good evening, and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I am your host this evening, Dr. Tensai Woreta, member of the P2P's Board of Directors. And tonight, I'm honored to have a panel of medical and public health professionals to discuss an important global health problem of chronic hepatitis B infection. So I'm going to introduce my three panelists. So we have Ms. Emmy Martin. Ms. Martin has over 10 years of experience in public health research and writing in academic, government, and community-based settings. Currently, she works within her passion of addressing the health needs of underserved communities as the project manager for cultural competency at Adventist Healthcare's Center for Health Equity and Wellness. In this role, she manages the activities of the center's project, Beat It. This stands for Becoming Empowered Africans Through Improved Treatment of Type 2 Diabetes, Hepatitis B, and HIV/AIDS, an initiative that's especially close to her heart as the daughter of Nigerian immigrants. Ms. Martin serves as an expert on African immigrant health, speaking in local, national, and international venues, including the Montgomery County, Maryland Gazette newspaper, Feature Story News, Blog Talk Radio's AfroZone program, and the American Public Health Association's 141st and upcoming 142nd annual meeting. Ms. Martin also leads cultural competency assessments for healthcare organizations and directs marketing and communication efforts as the chief editor of the Center for Health Equity and Wellness monthly electronic newsletter. She earned her master's in public health from St. Louis University and bachelor's of science in biochemistry from Brigham Young University. Our second panelist is Ms. Shari Cohen, and she is the chair of a national coalition against hepatitis in people of African origin. The purpose of this coalition is to promote national awareness around the large burden of viral hepatitis and hepatitis-related health disparities faced by people of African origin. The coalition is made up of medical, public health, and community leaders from around the country who are working in their local communities and at the national level to raise the profile of this problem, to share information and best practices, and advocate for increased research and programs. She earned her undergraduate degree at Lafayette College and a master's in public health at Temple University. She is currently a Doctor of Public Health candidate in the Drexel University School of Public Health doctoral program. And then finally, we have Dr. Pani Perumalswamy, who's an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Liver Diseases at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She earned her bachelor's of science from the University of Michigan and her MD degree from Wayne State University. She completed her internal medicine residency training at George Washington University and her gastroenterology fellowship at New York University. She joined Mount Sinai as a transplant hepatology fellow in 2008, and upon completion, she joined the faculty in the Division of Liver Diseases. As a health service researcher, she has devoted her career towards understanding barriers to and facilitators for accessing viral hepatitis screening and care in order to design innovative interventions to increase uptake into screening. And Dr. Pani is the director of Hepatitis Outreach Network, which is a community-based viral hepatitis outreach program that targets at-risk foreign-born communities to provide education, screening, and link to care. As a faculty, she obtained a master's in clinical research and was the recipient of a faculty development award from the American College of Gastroenterology and Tisch Cancer Institute Development Award. She is a co-principal investigator on a grant from NYS Health Foundation to develop an application for providers and hepatitis C infected patients using telemedicine. She was recently selected for the KL2 Faculty Scholars Program to support her research programs in recognition of her potential as an academic leader in clinical research. She has also been a recipient of the Department of Medicine Outstanding Medical Educator and directs the Liver Division Bench to Bedside Selective for first-year medical students. She is currently an investigator for many ongoing clinical trials evaluating the safety and efficacy of new antiviral treatments for hepatitis B, as well as hepatitis C. So I really thank our distinguished panelists, as you heard, for joining us today. I'm going to just start, just to give you a brief introduction on hepatitis B, and then we're going to go into the questions for our panelists. Just a brief background for our audience, especially those who know who don't have a medical background. Hepatitis B is a viral infection that affects the liver and can lead to chronic liver disease with active inflammation in the liver. Untreated, this may lead to irreversible scarring of the liver, known as cirrhosis, which may result in serious complications and death. Chronic hepatitis B is also a major risk factor for the development of liver cancer. An estimated 350 million people worldwide have chronic hepatitis B infection, and the prevalence is highest in sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia, where 5 to 10% of the adult population has chronic infection. In such areas where the prevalence is high, most people become infected during childhood or at birth from mother-to-child transmission. 15 to 25% of adults who become chronically infected during childhood will die from hepatitis B-related cirrhosis or liver cancer. In developed countries, the prevalence is higher among immigrants from high-prevalence countries. And hepatitis B infection is preventable through a safe and highly effective vaccine, and that has been available since 1982. And chronic hepatitis B can be treated with highly effective medications, including oral antiviral drugs, and these drugs are very well tolerated with minimal side effects. Treatment can prevent the development of complications such as cirrhosis and liver cancer, but unfortunately, the treatment is not widely available in many resource-limited settings. Okay, so with that introduction of our panelists and that background, we'll begin my question and answer session. So first, I would like to ask each of the panelists if they could tell us a little bit about how they became interested in doing work to address this global health problem of hepatitis B.
Hi, this is Sherry. So I was actually doing my graduate research project at Temple University, and it was the idea of liver cancer that first pulled me in to the problem of hepatitis B. When you learn a little bit about liver cancer, you realize that over the past few decades, while the survival rates for all other cancers have gone up, liver cancer survival rates remain incredibly low. Less than 10% of people live past 6 months after a diagnosis of liver cancer. And so it was originally in looking at liver cancer that I came to find hepatitis B, which is attributed, which actually causes about 80% of liver cancer worldwide. So that's originally how I was brought into it, and quickly realized that the way to prevent liver cancer is to prevent hepatitis B and to help people who have hepatitis B infections.
Okay, great. Hi, and this is Emma. As you mentioned in my bio, as a daughter of two Nigerian immigrants, I've always been passionate about affecting change within the African immigrant community. And thankfully, through my profession, I've been able to turn that passion into my professional 9-to-5. One of the great blessings of the work that I'm doing, and I will talk about more later, is that the Office of Minority Health at the federal level approached our organization, Adventist Healthcare, and made the request for us to take some of their national work for improving African immigrant health to a level both local and raise it to national awareness in the specific area of hepatitis B. So I've been blessed to have my passion just kind of fall into my lap in some great and unique ways, one of them being through Project Beat It.
Hi, this is Pune. So, you know, certainly as a hepatologist, I've kind of firsthand seen the healthcare disparities with respect to hepatitis B in foreign-born communities. So actually starting in 2009, we had a really unique opportunity through a private foundation to really craft a global health-related project. And because we live in New York City and over 35% of people who live in New York City are not born in this country, we really decided to focus our efforts around mostly hepatitis B, but hepatitis C as well, to really try to create a program around education, screening for hepatitis B, and link to care. What we certainly recognize is that this is a silent disease that really has a big impact or prevalence in foreign-born communities, particularly African, you know, particularly West African populations that we see living in New York, as well as East Asian communities, among other groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. It's always interesting to hear how, you know, you started in developing your interest in and carrying out such successful projects. So going into that, and I think maybe Dr. Pani, since you had started to discuss that, if each of you can tell us about the projects that you're working on to tackle this problem of hepatitis B, that would be great.
Yeah, so, you know, certainly from our experience, we started our project back in 2009, and, you know, what we found that it dovetailed pretty nicely, actually, with the Institute of Medicine report that ended up coming out a year later in 2010 about viral hepatitis and liver cancer. And as Sherry and Emma mentioned, you know, this is really, hepatitis B is a infectious disease that disproportionately affects foreign-born communities. And the rates of liver cancer in particular that we see are highest really in sub-Saharan Africans as well as East Asians living with this silent disease. So, you know, our work began a little over 5 years ago now, and we've done a lot of great work with the city and state departments of health in New York City and New York State, as well as a number of community-based organizations. And really that connection to the community through these community-based organizations has been a key aspect of what we've created. And that is really an education, screening, and link to care program. So really trying to close the loop, starting with educating communities that are at risk for hepatitis B, offering free screening or testing, and then using culturally targeted patient navigators to really, engage positive people for care, and then even for negative people, offer them vaccination if there's an opportunity for prevention. So, and certainly what I'll say is one of the great community-based organizations that we've had the pleasure of working with is an African Services Committee in Harlem, New York, which is a nonprofit multi-service organization that provides not only health-related opportunities and services, but health, housing, legal, education, and social services targeted to African diaspora communities living in New York City. And so kind of connecting with this group along with other partners, including the national groups that certainly Sherry's been very involved with, as well as the local public health departments, has, I think, created a really successful model around education, screening, and link to care.
That's wonderful. And Dr. Pani, can you elaborate how that at a big institution like Mount Mana, how were you able to forge those connections with the community-based organizations? Because I feel like sometimes that's a problem with big academic institutions where they're kind of isolated. So how were you able to create that?
So in New York City, I would say that we're definitely very lucky in that we have a very active and engaged public health kind of community around viral hepatitis B. And so going to some of the citywide meetings and community forums and kind of getting a sense of what people were interested in doing, what was already being done, and trying to kind of really partner and collaborate with communities has been a really important part of what we do. I think it's led for a lot of opportunities for us to combine efforts, have a bigger impact, not only on the community level, but then that public health and even policy level. I'll give you an example that New York City Council recently invited a number of groups to come and testify around the issue of viral hepatitis B and how this is really impacting the communities. And they're trying to, again, kind of being at the forefront of implementing and developing policies. A lot of our local council members have really kind of taken a stance because they represent a lot of foreign-born communities living here. I will say in New York City, a lot of the African communities that we've worked with have been largely West African communities, but we've done a lot of work in non-African communities as well, but since the focus today obviously is in our work in the African communities, that's where I'll kind of spend the time kind of focusing and talking about what we've done.
Okay. That's wonderful. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so we can either Ms. Emmy or Ms. Charlie, if you could details about the projects you've been working on.
Sure, this is Emma. So as I mentioned, the Federal Office of Minority Health approached the Center for Health Equity and Wellness at Adventist Healthcare several years ago, noting that there was a huge deficit in targeted efforts for the African immigrant community around hepatitis B. One of their projects or long-term goals is to reduce disparities and improve health outcomes in HIV and AIDS, as well as hepatitis B. And so they approached our organization with the charge to develop curricula that would meet the needs of the African immigrant patient by educating them about the disease, giving them tools to be better self-managers of their disease, and empowering them to be navigators of the healthcare system as far as treatment and access to care were concerned. And so we were able to develop curricula around how best to navigate and understand the medical system, why you should be medically adherent. And we also were able to train their providers of care. Anyone who said that they see a good number of African immigrant patients, we invited them to come to any of our trainings as we developed that curricula so that they could understand culturally some of the challenges and the nuances of being an African immigrant and be better equipped to communicate and increase medical adherence and health outcomes. And so that project started about 2-3 years ago now, but we've continued to keep the beat alive, as it were, for the name of Project Beat It, by continuing to meet with African patients, African consumers, as well as providers of care to just really help them feel empowered about how to navigate the system, why it's so important to be medically adherent, and ways that they can still honor and hold tight to their cultural values while still practicing healthy behaviors and doing the regimens that they're given and recommended by the providers of care.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, and Ms. Emmy, can you explain about the patient navigator concept and how you use that to engage the community?
Sure. So we didn't have officially tagged navigators, but what we did have was a community advisory board. We solicited about 30 people who have a handle on the African immigrant population here in the Washington, D.C. area, and we sought their feedback on the curricula as well as on effective ways to touch the community and bring them to the table so that they could receive this training. Interestingly enough, we solicited 30. We had 27 people accept our invitation, and of those 27 people, 24 of them were actually African immigrants themselves. And so we had a very diverse group of doctors, nurses, social workers, dietitians, clergy members, religious leaders coming together and giving us this input. And it was powerful because not only did they touch the community and had tie-ins and linkages to understanding the challenges of the African immigrant patient, but as I mentioned, 24, 27 of them have walked the walk and talked the talk of immigrating to the U.S. And so they understood the challenges, even though they may be well-educated, even though they may be professionals thriving and doing well now, they understood and walked in the shoes of some of their clients and their consumers that we're targeting. And so it was great to have their feedback to assist us in moving forward with engaging the community and bringing them to the table, because in the African culture, health, surprisingly, is not a top priority. It's not necessarily something that's talked about often or talked about at all. And so it was really effective to have good people at the table to help us find ways to make this project and this topic so important, engaging, and at the forefront of the consumers that we were trying to reach.
Okay, that's wonderful. Again, another example of how important it is to engage, you know, communities and community-based groups. So, okay, that's great. And then finally, we have Ms. Sherry. If you could,
sure.
How about your work? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. So I work at the SNAC Foundation, and we're just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And very much like my colleagues who you've heard from, we do work at a community-based level to improve screening and linkage to care. One of the things I think that most people don't realize is that while hepatitis B does disproportionately affect specific communities in the U.S., particularly foreign-born immigrants who come from countries where hepatitis B is endemic, most people in the U.S. don't know they're infected. So there's a situation where you have about 2 million people in the U.S. who are infected with hepatitis B, but only about 25% of them know they have the infection. And if they can't access appropriate care because they don't know they have it, then they're more likely to die prematurely from their disease. And so at the HIV Foundation, what we're doing is working to improve screening and linkage to care by figuring out what the barriers to screening and linkage to care are, and then working to overcome those barriers at a community level. And like my colleagues, we do that at a community-based approach, working with a coalition, a multidisciplinary coalition that includes researchers, community-based organizations, social service groups, community leaders, physicians, other healthcare providers in the health department. And that's in Philadelphia. And the idea is that if we can do it in Philly, we can do it anywhere in the U.S. And so we now have a few different national coalitions. One is Hep B United, where we're working with over 22 coalitions in 13 states now to try and address hepatitis B through community work, through improving screening and linkage to care in these states. And one of the things that we try and do together is help improve the capacity of everybody working at the local level. We all know that public health now and working at the local community nonprofit environment can be very difficult in terms of constraints. And so working together, we can share resources, share information and knowledge, and help to improve our capacity. And that's really important. One of the things we try and do is one of the things we do is work with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to partner on the No Hep B campaign, which is a national campaign to improve awareness about hepatitis B. And one of the biggest things is to try and dispel myths around it, and that is another barrier to screening and linkage to care. There are certain beliefs and myths that have been propagated, things like, misunderstandings about how hepatitis B is spread, or misunderstandings about that there's no treatment for hepatitis B, that serve as a barrier. And so one of the things we try and do with the No Hep B campaign is to get out very simple and accurate information so that people are more likely to be tested and more likely to talk about hepatitis B to help reduce some of the stigma that surrounds it. And so the CHIPO, the national coalition that we have now, we are working with organizations and individuals around the country who are trying specifically to reduce hepatitis B and address hepatitis B in African immigrant communities by information sharing. I think one of the problems is that there's not a lot of research that has been done in this area. And honestly, hepatitis B tends not to be a very prioritized disease in the U.S., although that has changed over the past few years. And so by working together, I think what we're trying to do is improve awareness at the community level, but also at the federal level, to make sure that hepatitis B and the groups that are affected by hepatitis B are prioritized. You know, once they prioritize the disease and they prioritize the groups, then hopefully we'll be able to see change, more funding for research, more funding for programs, and the social and political will to make change happen.
That is wonderful. And Shari, can you tell us about, in terms of the use of the coalition, the CHIPO coalition, can you tell us examples of the academic community or the community
members that are part of that, just to give us an idea of the coalition? I know you said it was a national coalition. Can you give us an idea of the members?
Yes, absolutely. So, again, it is a very multidisciplinary group. We have a lot of community-based organizations. So, for instance, one of our members is HBIDC, which is Hepatitis B Initiative of Washington, D.C. They're a local community group, and they do screening and education events for Asian and African communities in Washington, D.C. and the surrounding area. So they join us. And then on the other hand, we have the Mayo Clinic. They're researchers and providers, hepatologists, and they're looking for better ways to also reach out to the community. So you wind up having lots of different groups come together for the same purpose, which is I think, why we tend to be so successful, because there's so much to share. We also have health departments, and they play a critical role in reaching out to particularly the underserved communities. So the New York City Health Department is part of it, and the Philadelphia Health Department is part of it. And so I think what you have is great minds coming together for a common goal.
Okay, that's wonderful. That really, it's interesting because, you know, Dr. Ananga Mahari, people to people, that's really one of the points that he always emphasizes, that, you know, to attack a problem that's affecting our communities, it has to be, you know, putting great, you know, all these great minds alike, including the community, academic institutions, the health department, the government, all sectors working together for this common cause. So it's really fascinating to hear from each of your projects how that incorporates all elements of that. So, okay. So, and moving into, I think we can probably start with you, Shari, since you've already touched on this. Can you tell us just some examples of the successes that the projects that you've been working on have led to? Just some, you can be specific or broad.
Sure, absolutely. So I think what we're all learning is that if you use culturally competent approaches and you bring the community into the work that you're doing every step of the way, you can see success. And when we say community, you know, I think what we're looking at is you have to bring together all of the stakeholders, the people who are affected by hepatitis B as well as the people who are treating them and everyone in between. And so we have been able to see successes. If you do things from that kind of perspective, you can get people screened and you can get people linked to care. You look at the power of small community organizations. And so at Happy United Philadelphia, you know, 5 years ago, we didn't even exist. And 5 years later, we've reached thousands of people. We've been able to offer screening to almost 3,000 people, and we've directly educated about 10,000 people. But even more importantly than that is we've actually sort of seen a paradigm shift in Philadelphia, where 5 years ago, people never spoke about hepatitis B. And now when you're, you know, when we go to events, providers are talking about hepatitis B. Social service organizations are talking about hepatitis B. You know, people, when we walk into the room, people know us. Oh, hepatitis B. And so I think the more that is a huge success, is just improving awareness and helping people to talk about hepatitis B.
That's great. Okay. And Dr. Pani or Emma, you can feel free to elaborate on any of the successes, specific or general, that of your organizations.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Shari and Emma have really hit it on the head in terms of really looking at the effectiveness of kind of culturally both appropriate and sensitive strategies to try to really engage communities. You know, Emma had spoken to the effectiveness of culturally targeted patient navigators, and it's just really interesting to see how we've kind of arrived at kind of the same, utilizing the same types of effective kind of concepts to make these programs, you know, collectively a success. You know, in our program, we have a former USAID worker from Senegal who is able to really do a lot of community engagement. And we also work a lot with community gatekeepers to really engage them, you know, help us sort out the best ways to target these communities in terms of education, providing screening. And then really a big part of what we've done is understanding kind of what the barriers are greeting and follow-up care. And I think that's kind of, again, to kind of really make our all of our education strategies really effective. You know, this is a largely silent disease. It's not uncommon for people to get diagnosed when they present with very late complications, such as an inoperable or untreatable liver cancer. And many of these patients can oftentimes be young. So really trying to engage the community, understand what's the best modes to provide this education and testing, and then work with these kind of culturally appropriate, culturally engaging, you know, patient navigators or other strategies, and then understanding those barriers so that we can try to sort out what's the best way to overcome those barriers to get more people aware about this problem and to understand that we do have, for example, highly effective vaccines, as you mentioned at the start of the program, to prevent this problem. We have effective ways to manage and treat and follow these patients if that's needed. So really kind of, I think those have been the biggest successes that certainly we've seen.
Wonderful. Okay, great. Okay, and then and anything else to add? To...
Sure. Just to underscore what both Dr. Pawnee and Sherry have said, the key word, I think, is community. Really bringing the community to the table and engaging them, as Sherry mentioned, from beginning. We often in public health or in medicine want to say that we're doing something that's community-based, but then the community is almost an afterthought. But especially with the African immigrant population, trust is such a huge factor in getting anything done. And so engaging them from beginning to end is so critical. And that was truly essential to our success. We only succeeded when the community was involved, when our advisory board was providing input and at the table and our hands on the ground, our feet on the ground, as it were. And so we were able to touch not only the Washington, D.C. area, which is where our organization is based and where we were charged to implement this program, but by word of mouth, and again, the community members that came to the table and their connections. We also did some trainings in Pittsburgh with about 120 residents and physicians at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center because, again, our community was involved. They spread the word. They got the fire going, and people were interested, and they wanted to learn more. And so over 800 healthcare providers were trained through Project Beat It. We were able to get into doors and places that would not have happened with the African immigrant community because we engaged the leadership of the community, brought them to the table, and told them from the beginning what we were trying to do, why it was important. And once you get the community buy-in, the doors open. But you have to get the community buy-in. You have to get the community on board. And so if I can say community 15 million more times, you know, maybe get an endorsement for somebody who's giving away community funds, I don't know. All three of us can underscore that point enough. It really is the heart of the community that makes these programs effective.
Definitely played a role in the success, the tremendous success that that you're describing. So that is wonderful. So just for the audience, we've reached the halfway mark of the show. It's about 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So you're listening to the Global Health Forum brought to you by People to People. Today we have a group of wonderful panelists discussing their work in tackling a major global health problem of chronic hepatitis B. And at this point, we'll open the show for audience questions if we have any audience questions.
There are no questions at the moment.
Okay. All right. So then we'll continue as the questions come. Then we'll allow our audience to ask questions. Otherwise, I'll just continue with our discussion. And again, this was a bit touched on earlier, but I was wondering if each of you could describe some of the major barriers and challenges you've encountered in your work for this cause. Actually, maybe we could start with Emma this time.
Sure. So one of the challenges, as I mentioned, one of the great blessings of the program is getting the community involved. And so bringing them to the table, getting their insights, very helpful. Where we experience some challenges are in reaching the African immigrant population. As I mentioned earlier, excuse me, somebody's clearing my throat. As I mentioned earlier, African immigrant health is not always at the forefront of the African immigrant patient. And so trying to bring this awareness, the importance of health within the African immigrant community was a huge barrier to overcome, just to help make sure that African immigrants understood the importance, understood why they should come to the table, why this is important. That was a challenge, and it really was overcome through the community involvement.
Okay. Do you think part of that would have been, because I know with some health issues, for example, HIV/AIDS, you know, there's a taboo, like, stigma associated with it that sometimes, did you find that with hepatitis B, being that it is, you know, an infectious disease?
Absolutely. That presented probably the chief challenge and barrier with overcoming the taboo of the disease and how it's transmitted. And within the African community, we don't really, the saying goes among many that we don't have sex, we just have babies. And so we don't have that dialogue about sexual health. We don't have that dialogue about sex. There are many of my peers who were born in this country whose parents never had the birds and the bees talk with them. And it's not that there wasn't love or that they didn't want to have that education, but they never had that conversation. They didn't even receive that conversation from their parents. And so to talk about things around sexual health, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in the home, and so heaven forbid it should happen outside of the home. Definitely a challenge trying to get people to even understand that this has to be discussed in order to overcome and address the true issue behind the disease. And so that presented a huge challenge just in marketing the program and getting people to accept that we can have this discussion, accept the fact that we can bring them to the table and have this discussion, difficult as it is, unnecessary as it is. And so once we're able to overcome that, and, you know, I dare say that we've overcome it because it's still a challenge. It's still a challenge to help people understand the importance of having this discussion, as taboo and uncomfortable as it is, but it needs to be held. And again, the community has done a great job at helping us get into the communities, touching the consumers, and helping them to rely upon us and giving us the trust that we can have this discussion. We're not just here to exploit or make you uncomfortable, but we're really here to try to improve your health outcomes and your lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So, and you have you seen a change over time? I know with HIV there's been a big change in terms of, you know, decreasing the stigma. Have you seen a similar the trend for hepatitis B?
We've definitely seen an increase in awareness. I think if there's any take-home message that we have observed with this project is that just bringing the visibility of hepatitis B, of HIV and AIDS to the forefront, having the discussion. That, it sounds like a small thing, but it's truly a powerful notion that when people see me in the community and they say, hey, you're the beat it girl. Hey, you're the girl who talks about HIV and AIDS, hepatitis B. That's a big thing. Again, coming from a community that doesn't even talk about health, much less sexual health. And so having that awareness, having that willingness and that openness to discuss it has probably been one of the greatest watershed moments of this project, that we're able to have this discussion, that we're comfortable with having it, that within the community there's a call and a plea to sit at the table and have these conversations and educate one another to improve their health. So I think that's probably one of the greatest outcomes and greatest thing achievements that we've observed, just a greater openness, a greater awareness.
Okay, great. And so, Dr. Pani or Sharli, if you want to, if you had wanted to discuss any of the challenges that you've encountered.
Yeah, I would say that there certainly have been a number of challenges, and I think my colleagues have discussed this in a bit so far. But certainly, I would start with funding. A lot of the differences that we see around HIV and Hep B and kind of where things were and where things have come a lot of that has to do with funding for programs to increase awareness, increase screening, increase linkage to care, increasing access to medications. So I think, you know, that really starts at the top. So really getting better policies and funding mechanisms to do a lot of the much-needed work that we're discussing. I also think that a big challenge has always been, you know, again, going back to this being a silent infection until things are almost too late for us to really help people with this problem. So, you know, the challenge of trying to educate communities that are at risk to get tested, to know their status when there are often obviously competing challenges that these communities and individuals are facing. The other things I would say certainly are finding better pathways for uninsured and undocumented persons with these infections. You know, we've actually done work looking at, again, going back to understanding what some of the barriers are. And some of the barriers include, you know, a lack of awareness or knowledge around hepatitis B, but there are also system-wide barriers like navigating the complexities of the U.S. medical system, you know, communities being unaccustomed to preventive care, so really only seeking care when they feel sick, a lot of language and health literacy issues, availability and accessibility of screening. And then we've also found a lot of fear of disclosure of their status if they're positive and what impact that can have on them as an individual, their family, and their, you know, status within their communities here. And then, again, stigma and really how social systems influence accessing. And then I'd kind of end by saying that also another big challenge is still really understanding the modes of transmission in some of these communities. You know, we certainly know that globally, hepatitis B, the major pathway for transmission, more than 50% at least worldwide, is from what we call vertical or mother-to-child transmission, followed by, you know, sexual transmission. But I think there are some additional pathways that are not as well understood. Certainly in the communities that we've done a lot of screening in over 1,600 Sub-Saharan West Africans, we find very high rates of exposure and yet still relatively high rates of infection, but that don't match the rates of exposure. So it's really suggestive of perhaps young childhood transmission. So, you know, part of that would be increasing the perinatal vaccination programs in a lot of the home countries that persons originate from and doing better work to understand, you know, how this virus is transmitted in a lot of the communities in the home country, because I don't think they fit into a lot of the kind of traditionally understood risk factors, if you will, or modes of transmission.
That's a really great point, and we can see from the success actually of the universal vaccination program in Taiwan, where there was a high incidence of, you know, childhood and perinatal. So there was a tremendous success in decreasing the number of infections and the incidence of liver cancer. So I think that's a very important point. Okay, and then and Shari, anything else to add? That any other challenges that you faced?
I think just one thing, I agree with everything that both my colleagues said. One of the biggest issues that we find is lack of provider awareness about hepatitis B, you know, particularly at the primary care level. So there actually are guidelines in place now in the United States, both from the CDC and the United States Preventive Services Task Force, to screen high-risk individuals for hepatitis B. But part of the problem is that, you know, the communities aren't the only ones who have low awareness of hepatitis B. We at the provider level also need to do a better job of making sure that particularly primary care providers know who to screen and also know how to screen. And that can be really difficult in today's world, particularly when primary care providers have so many different competing interests, that competing diseases and conditions that they have to deal with when they're looking at patients. And so we're trying to come up with ways, I know, around the country of helping providers out to make sure that people are getting screened when they get to the doctor's office. Things like EMR pop-ups, you know, now that a lot of hospital systems are using electronic medical records, making sure that people who could be in a high-risk category are automatically flagged so that the provider might notice and then be more likely to screen. And also working to empower patients and community members so that they can go to their doctor's office and ask to be tested. But definitely, I think a lack of awareness at all levels has been a challenge.
My God, that's a very excellent point. I completely agree. I mean, I think in my experience, I've seen patients who've had contact with primary care providers and, you know, were never screened, even with a strong family history and, you know, the parental history. So, and it's really devastating when you find liver cancer or, you know, other complications that are, like Dr. Pani was saying, too late at some point. So I think that's a very good point that more awareness in terms of primary care providers and screening would also be beneficial. So, okay, well, we do have one audience question that I received actually from Dr. Inauka, and it's about what our panelists think about the Ebola infection and if you see any common denominator to the other infections such as hepatitis B. And if anyone has any thoughts on that.
This is Shari. I mean, I think just from a social perspective, there are definite similarities you see with cultural competency and working with communities to make sure they understand what is involved with the disease, particularly when you're talking about things like stigmatized diseases, and with Ebola, of course, you have the potential of quarantine, but really working with communities to help educate them and make sure that they understand and that you all have the same, you're all working from the same place and having the same dialogue, that is a definite similarity. If you want to make any inroads and have successes.
Okay, definite. That does seem to be key in this epidemic as well, working with the communities and building an awareness. Okay, great. Any other thoughts from Dr. Pani or Emma?
I would say that certainly, you know, building infrastructure to kind of care for these problems is what we're kind of hearing again in the a lot of the information that's being put out around Ebola. And certainly I think it has general applicability to infectious diseases, but then, you know, chronic diseases as well. You know, certainly it's something that, you know, New York now kind of being one of the areas that's now going to be screening more patients in the airport. I do worry about issues around stigma. I think a lot of the reports that we heard from out of the patient who was in Dallas, you know, I think these things have the potential to potentially negatively impact the community. But I think we need to kind of really forge ahead and continue to do a lot of our community engaged work, really educate people on obviously the differences between these types of infectious disease, and just really show our commitment to working with communities in need. So.
All right, great.
And this is Emma. I agree with both what Dr. Pani and Sherry said. It's really about engaging and educating and being proactive in doing that, especially as things are just at the cusp of perhaps becoming unhinged. This is definitely the time to bring people to the table, providers and patients alike, and do the education, do the engagement now.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent. Thank you for your thoughts. That's very, very very insightful, and I think we'll move on to, I think we have an audience question, I believe. I think. Do you have an audience? Hello?
Hello? From area code 410. Yes.
Okay,
great.
And if you could just introduce yourself and then ask your question. Mm-hmm.
Yes, my name is Dr. Fatika. I'm from Johns Hopkins Hospital. I had a question for the panel. I'm sort of outside of my field, which is ophthalmology, but I had a question about what a very important point that you mentioned, which is about cost. And I think part of the success of the HIV epidemic in this country was the availability of testing and then programs like the Ryan White, which would enable federal programs, which ensured that everybody would get treatment. So, and with hepatitis, I know the cost of the medications are extremely expensive. And you also mentioned, a lot of these patients may be uninsured or undocumented. So, you know, once you screen them and test them, you know, are you seeing federal programs that will, you know, help these patients get treatment and things? And I foresee that to be a barrier. And I would just like to you to expand on that a little bit more.
Let's see if we can open up to any of the panelists who have thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is Pune. I think this remains a big challenge, and I think, again, to kind of highlight the differences of kind of how far we've come with a condition like HIV and where we really want to go with Hep B, a lot of this comes down to funding. You know, Ryan White related programs really opened the door to access to vitally needed care, treatment, medications around HIV, and I think these types of things are still very much needed and remain an unmet need, I would say, in the realm of viral hepatitis B. There certainly are, in our program, we work a lot with community health centers, federally qualified health centers, case managers to see, you know, who could be potentially eligible for insurance access. We also do know that some of the pharma companies that make some of the antiviral medications for hepatitis B actually don't ask for documentation status to enroll in patient assistance programs. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done. And, you know, this remains even a challenge in the home countries for a lot of these communities where folks are immigrating from, access to affordable medications, you know, knowing that suppression of Hep B viral load can significantly reduce your risk of developing liver cancer and liver cirrhosis, and then to have really good drugs, which we do have, and not have persons have access to it, you know, is just a crime. So I definitely think more work on national level, certainly for more funding for these types of program and policies around this are very much needed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much, and I commend the work that you're all doing. Thank you.
This is Emma. To echo what Shari and Dr. Pani have said previously, one of the challenges with hepatitis B is that even at the provider level, there's a lot of ignorance in that there's just not enough awareness of the disease, what needs to be done, basic information for screening. And I think you, as a caller with this question, are a great example of what it means to be aware, to be proactively engaged, and that you have an ophthalmology background, but here you are listening and trying to educate yourself, trying to be informed. And so it comes down to us telling our stories. You as a physician, going back to your colleagues and saying, you know, I just listened to this great panel about hepatitis B. Do you know what that is? Educating each other. And those who are affected with the disease, telling the stories. The African culture is so story-based, and that oration is the way that we pass histories. And so that's the way we can engage the community in becoming more versed about what the disease is. And when those stories get to the forefront, then they get to the eyes and ears of the people with the funding. And once there's a name behind those stories and a face and a person, there's power in that. I mean, the very funding you're referencing, Ryan White, is named after a young man whose story hit someone, touched them in such a way that this funding has driven the research and the medications and all of the things that we now have in place that are commonplace. We don't think about them, but with HIV and AIDS, they started somewhere. They started with a story. And so we really have to be vigilant in telling the story of hepatitis B, telling the stories of survival and telling the stories of that don't turn out so well, so that there is a connection, and not just a personal connection, but a mind connection of understanding and awareness. And so I think that will really be what drives the funding.
All right, thank you very much. All right. I didn't. And Shari, if you do, you have anything else to add or?
No, I think everybody said it well. I mean, the only thing I have to hope is that with the Affordable Care Act now, that there will be more options for people who are uninsured now, but are potentially insurable in terms of getting treatment.
That's a good point, Lee. Thank you. Okay. And I think we're getting close to the end of the show. I just wanted to see if any of you had any advice to the members of People to People. I know there's a lot of medical professionals and non-medical professionals listening in. And, you know, if you had any advice to them on how they can contribute to the cause or, and I know there's probably a lot of people who've heard the program and want to help. And if you had any advice on that and how they could get involved in the efforts.
This is Shari. I think continuing the conversation is the most important thing. If we could get everybody to talk about hepatitis B, if you're a community member, the next time you're at your doctor's office, ask to be tested. Talk to your family members about hepatitis B. Talk to your friends about hepatitis B, about how it spread, about how easy it is to be tested, and how if you do have hepatitis B, it's just like any other chronic condition and it can be managed. And if you're a provider at any level, talk to patients, talk to clients, talk to colleagues, and keep the conversation going.
Wonderful. Thank you.
This is Emma. To say another C word, and the C word that I mentioned earlier, community, it really comes back to the community involvement. Again, just to echo what's been previously said, as we bring people to the table and educate them and make them aware, then they are the banner. They are the leaders that will go forward and spread the word. They will be able to teach each other, and that word will spread. And so we really have to get the community at the table. So as Shari mentioned, ask your physicians, ask your colleagues, get people engaged on this subject, keep the conversation going, and make it visible.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Pani, any last any advice?
No, I would just say that I echo what both Emma and Shari said. I couldn't have said it better. So I think keeping the conversation going is what's really going to help us make strides.
Wonderful. Thank you. So Emma, Shari, Dr. Pani, I would like to sincerely thank you for spending an hour on this program with us. It was very insightful, and it's just fascinating to hear about your work and your dedication, and we wish you the best success in continuing your wonderful work. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And
thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Okay, and then we thank our audience for listening, and thank you very much. Just wanted to remind the audience, please tune into next week's show, next Thursday, October 16th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Dr. Lydia Tesfa will be hosting Dr. Zaki Sharif, Professor of Microbiology and Biochemistry at Georgetown University, to discuss recent advances in breast cancer research. So again, thank you, my wonderful panelists, and thank you, audience, for listening. Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.